a lot of people live in denial because they think that to be realistic is to be depressing.
I'm Dr. Mike, host of Going There.
It was the first song where I wrote about how I felt like my depression was killing me and I didn't want it.
Going There breaks the stigma of mental health issues by having real, honest conversations with your favorite musicians, including Alessia Cara, Lizzie Hale, Jewel, Jason Isbell, Gerard Way, Lauren Gray, Shamir, and Barty Strange.
There was something there that was so raw, where I was like, wow, I can't believe someone would say that.
Let's go there on Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network, every other Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Everyone, welcome to this week's Modern Drummer Podcast. Billy Amendola here. I gotta say that, I'm always excited when I do a podcast because I'm fans of just about everybody. I won't do an interview if I'm not a fan of somebody, because that's just me. So I've been a fan of our next guest since probably
3 weeks ago.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago.
This is about 3 weeks ago.
3 weeks. Yeah. No, but seriously, probably since the 90s. So, ladies and gentlemen, Josh Friesch.
Hello. Hey. How are you?
I'm good, man. Thank you so much for taking this time, because I got to say, I did have to do some research because you do so much that... The only other person I think who makes my head spin like that is buddy Kenny Arnoff.
Yeah, Kenny's a busy boy as well. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but I mean, if people are not familiar, hopefully they'll learn something more about you or just be reminded from this. And if not, they look them up. You'll see that it's mind-boggling. And where do you get this energy?
I have no idea. I mean, to be honest, I think it's just like muscle memory kind of shit, as far as not just meaning literally my muscles, but just the way that I schedule things and my work ethic and my stamina, even if it's off stage, just in the travel and the lack of sleep and the keeping set lists together in my head. It's just something I've done my entire life. I've done it since I was a teenager, So having done that constantly for, over 30 years, 35 years now of playing professionally, it just becomes kind of second nature. And not just the on the stage stuff, but the off the stage stuff too. Even though, there's something to be said for both those things are still challenging, meaning I don't walk on stage and I'm on autopilot. You know what I mean? Still walking on stage, giving it my all and concentrating and focusing and really going for it. And same with being off stage and traveling. It's like, I was in Greece last week for like 72 hours and I was like just completely spun around. I flew there, I played 3 gigs with Sting, I flew back, had a day off, went back into some other stuff. And it's like, you sleep in 2-hour increments, and you, you know, you sleep when you can and you try and eat well and you just try and get through. Like I knew when I was going to Greece, I knew I had to just like pace myself and take any opportunity I could to rest or do whatever I needed to do to be prepared enough for the gig. So when I was on stage and I'm going on zero sleep and actually it's, you know, it's 9 p.m. there, but really to me, it's 2 in the afternoon and I've been up all night. Or to, you know what I mean? It's like meaning just like, you know, trying to, I didn't have enough time to try and calibrate myself, recalibrate onto their schedule. Because I'm like, well, shit, I'm going home on Sunday anyways. Why am I going to try and get on their schedule? I'm going to blink and I'm getting back on a plane. So it's like, just stuff like that. You know, like I said, I'm used to it. Like I tell it to people and they go, man, I can't believe you did that. But it's still challenging. You know what I mean? As much as I say, oh yeah, muscle memory or, you know, it's like, nah, it's still a lot of work, but you know, I signed up for it and I like having the opportunity to do it. I got to be honest. There was a time probably about 10 years ago and I just done a gig with somebody and the next morning I was getting up really early, meaning I was getting up at, you know, I don't know, 4:30 for a 6:15 flight somewhere. And I'm flying in the day of a gig for somebody else. And my drum tech that was with me, we're walking around the airport at 4:45 or 5 a.m. after 2 hours sleep. And I'm going, man, I was about to say, maybe because I was just completely exhausted, I don't know what else to say. Maybe I was just making conversation, but I was about to say, God, this is the worst, right? And right when I was about to say, this is the worst, I caught myself and I went, you love this shit. I'm thinking to myself, you love this stuff. You love going on zero sleep and being, you know, red-eyed and walking like a zombie through the airport to get on a flight to do a gig. This is the shit that you wanted to do, you know? And I'm still grateful that I have the opportunity to do it. And so, you know, I guess any freelance person will tell you it's tough to say no to things. So you get, you know, programmed to say yes to everything. And it's been kind of liberating in the last few years between getting older and also with the pandemic hitting and realizing, oh my God, you know, everyone's lives getting turned upside down.
Yeah, touring took some hit on that.
Absolutely. But I realized too, even before the pandemic, I was getting used to actually starting to say no a little bit. And the
that break came in handy in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. For a year and a half, I didn't have to say no because there was no... There was no one to say yes.
There was no one to say no. I had a bunch of buddies calling me saying, Billy, man, can you have anything for me? You have anything that I could do? Can I write a story? Can I, because you know, they weren't used to being just home doing nothing. But some of them loved it. Now they don't want to go back on the road.
Well, I gotta be honest. I've got four young kids. And I've got four young kids and I travel a lot, I tour a lot, and I have my entire life. So it's really like when I couldn't talk about it too much in certain circles of friends of mine, because I had a lot of musicians, a lot of working musicians that really took a hit, you know what I mean? And it was really difficult financially, mentally, you know. And for me, I felt lucky enough that I had a support system in my wife and kids, and also had saved a little bit of money, you know, and didn't have the burden of financial woes, you know, as much as I went, holy mackerel, I'm making a lot less money than I've ever made in my entire life. I kind of, after I took a couple, you know, deep breaths and went, you know, I'm going to be okay. And this is going to be all right. And like I said, once I started getting used to being at home and kind of like getting to the groove of not being constantly busy, I did enjoy it. You know, there were some definite silver linings to things. But I couldn't talk about it too much around friends of mine that were really suffering. I couldn't go, man, isn't it great having to be home and just sitting around? Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
But, you know, there's lots of guys that did not feel that way. And for, you know, obvious, understandable reasons. And I went to New York about 4 months ago. I went to New York to do a little bit of recording with Sting. And it was the first time I've been on a plane in 14 months, which is a record for me. Even when I was an infant, my family would fly from Southern California to visit relatives back in Minnesota once or twice a year. I'm always flying, right? So it's like, it was the first time I've been on the ground that long. And when I flew to New York, I really thought that I was going to land and be like, oh, yes, I'm out of town again and I'm working. And after a day or so of being on my own and walking around the city between the studio and my hotel, I was like kind of lonely, kind of missed my kids and my dogs and my wife. I was like, man, maybe I want to be back home. Maybe I don't want to be out here, you know?
Yes.
But anyways, the grass is always greener, right?
Yeah. You know? And you know, the sad part is hopefully it did teach a lot of people, you know, that time is so valuable. And who you give your time to and who you spend your time with is very, very important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I, right when the pandemic hit and I realized, and I started taking it seriously, you know, meaning I remember, you know, first we heard the news, the stuff was happening over on the other side of the world.
Right,
we'd see footage of, you know, little towns in China being completely shut down, cities in China being shut down. I remember hearing a friend of mine up in Seattle, because they were the first, I think they were kind of like patient zero for, you know, cases in the States. I have some friends who live up in Seattle, and I talked to a buddy of mine who said, yeah, they closed, you know, they closed my kid's school for the rest of the week. And I was like, oh, wow. I'm like, that's pretty heavy, man. And I thought, wow, I'm glad I don't live in Seattle, you know, where all that bad stuff happens, unlike Southern California. And, you know, within days, it was like, you know, it was all over. So when I realized, wow, okay, all this stuff is going away and I'm not going on tour. And I was rehearsing at the time for Coachella. I was going to go play Coachella with Danny Elfman. I was really excited about all these things started just vanishing kind of overnight and just getting knocked over like dominoes one by one. I kind of had to say, you know what? You know, I built a studio at my house 10 years ago and I've never really had the time to like dive into it. And I've always kind of complained about not having the time to dive into it. But the good news has been, I've always been busy out in the real world, working at world-class studios, traveling all over the place, playing gigs. I've had no reason to have to, you know, hunker down in my studio in my backyard to do sessions, because I've always been busy doing real sessions, right? So I thought, man, you know, I've got a handful of friends that do that kind of stuff, that do remote recording for people and have for a long time, mm-hmm. pre-pandemic, that have just figured it out, you know. But so I kind of like really started to, I really had to look at it and learn how to use it. You know, I knew how to use it a little bit, but I really had to think to myself and go, okay, that can't just be like a hobby demo thing where I do favors for people back there. I really have to, like, I've got the gear, some of the know-how. I should be able to make this work, you know, and without really like, you know, going out and having to beg for work, just kind of like letting a few, you know, a handful of producer friends of mine and other musicians know that at a place, and for them too, they weren't able allowed to go out and do studio stuff anymore.
So yeah, having a home studio, that saved a lot of people.
Yeah, because it wasn't just me needing to do remote work. It was like
sanity people.
That too, yeah, will bring me to something else. But I mean, just like even other guys, that everyone else that was working, anything anyone was doing was going to have to be remotely from a home studio. So it's not like I was just open for business in my home studio. It's like every engineer I knew was working from home. Every producer I knew was doing sessions from homes, farming stuff out and sending people stems to work on at their respective places, you know. And so the whole world kind of, I mean, and for all different kinds of businesses, right? Everyone's, if you work in an office, you're no longer going into the office. You're just doing it at home. Doing these great Zoom calls and all that. Zoom, yeah.
Zoom became like the only way to communicate.
Yeah, I know. I'm still kicking myself for not investing in Zoom like the day the pandemic was started, you know?
Everybody, I know.
You know? But, and, you know, when you say the sanity part, it's like I started, you know, I've got a record coming out in a couple of weeks, right? I've got two records coming out. They're two solo records and they're a collection of 1 minute songs. All of them are what, there's 41 1 minute songs, just 20 on the first volume and 21 on the second volume.
I love it.
And it's great because if you don't like the song, by the time you can push skip, it's going to be over. So just deal with it, you know?
I love it. You know, one of the first things that I loved about you, besides you playing, but I knew that you were a really cool guy, was when you did the whole goof kind of GoFundMe thing. I mean, because I've always been against that, you know, personally. Yeah. And Modern Drummer could not, people would call and say, can you promote this? And we said, no, we're not going to promote any of that stuff. Because I mean, you know, come on. When I was growing up, you had to have a budget, and you had to get your money from wherever you had to get it, and you had to make a record. You don't beg people to give you money to make a record.
Yeah.
So when you came up with that whole thing, for people who don't know, real quickly, Josh came up with this like GoFundMe kind of thing.
But it wasn't really GoFundMe. My record was already made. What it was, I wasn't asking for people to just give me money to do something. I made a record, and then people have started to do these things where they had different tiers. Like,
right.
If you want an LP and you want it signed, it's going to be $50.
Right.
But
right.
For $75, you also throw in a t-shirt. So I started doing things like, yeah, buy my record.
Wash my
Yeah, but for $300, you get my record, a signed drum head, and we go have lunch at P.F. Chang's. Like, instead of being all this ridiculous shit, give you a tour of Disneyland, you know? It was all this ridiculous shit, you know?
I love it.
Give you a haircut, you know? Like, just ridiculous stuff.
That was brilliant, because people did it after you. I never saw anybody do it before you, but people did do that after you, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That was one of the things I was like, oh, this guy's cool. Not only is he amazing player, talented musician, but this guy's pretty cool.
Yeah, thanks, man. I try to have fun with it, you know.
That's the thing. This is supposed to be fun. But now I wanted to ask you, because you do so much, and because, all right, you come from a musical family, because your brother's pretty successful, your dad's pretty successful as a musician, well respected and everything. And you started very young, but did you always pay attention to the business part of the music business, or did it take you a while? Or do you still not really pay attention?
I pay attention now, but I don't pay a ton of attention to it. And I definitely didn't when I was younger. I also wasn't running around drinking and taking drugs and just like partying and doing gigs. When I was a kid, I was very serious with my work ethic and being dependable and being clear for all my gigs and stuff, you know? And so I definitely was more responsible and more of a professional, I think, at a really young age compared to a lot of other people that were teenagers playing rock music at the time. But I wasn't, you know, if you ask me, I mean, all the time I'll get like a royalty check or a publishing check for something for digital downloads or for this or that, or for music that's used in reruns for television shows I played on. And I'll get these checks and I'll be like, I have no idea why I'm getting, I don't even remember playing on the soundtrack of this movie. Why are they, it's a work for hire. Why am I getting paid a residual? Like, but I'm not going to call and hunt them down and go, why are you paying me? It's like, sure, I'll take the check. Right. But I don't even know how a lot of that stuff works. You know what I mean? I know there's some kind of, there's a few different avenues and kind of, coalitions that are getting, you know, studio musicians paid on stuff where maybe they should be getting paid a little bit of money on things that have sold millions and millions of copies, where originally it might have been just a work for hire thing. So yeah. I might have done the session and gotten paid X amount of dollars, and if it goes off and sells 10 million copies, I don't see any of that money, and that's fine, because that was agreed upon in the beginning. That's just the way it is. But there seems to be a few different things now and a few different companies that are kind of like looking out for the little guy, you know, and the studio drummer or the studio bassist on a track. And so, yeah, I'm starting to get all these weird kind of mystery tracks here and there. And like I said, I'm fine with it. I'm not hunting anyone down going, why are you sending me this? But I'm kind of like, why are they sending me this?
Thank God they're sending me, because a lot of people they're not sending to that they should be sending to. So that's
right.
You know, that's why you got, you know, the business. Like, you know, we try to teach that now, especially because, you know, even me growing up, I never paid attention to business. I signed papers away. I lost publishing, you know, the whole thing, which everybody does. So these days, there's no reason for people to be ripped off by anyone, because they should know better now. You know, the younger generation.
Absolutely.
They have it hard enough with the business.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So besides, let's go back now. Besides dad, who were some of your influences growing up?
Well, I'd say my first two favorite drummers, meaning when I was starting when I was eight, maybe, is when I really started paying attention. It's funny, my dad, having been the conductor of the Disneyland band, the big band out of Disneyland, there's pictures that date back to when I was 2 years old, like holding drumsticks, like standing like with the Disneyland marching band, like with a hat on, like while they play a set, like sitting next to the drummer tapping on the railing. You know what I mean? And then, but then a year later, there's pictures of me when I'm 3 or 4 with a plastic clarinet or a plastic saxophone sitting with it. So I was always around all this music and I really loved it and was obviously taken with it from a very young age, but I didn't really start playing drums until I was probably about 8. Between like 8 and 9 around then.
Which is young, especially years ago. Like yeah, now yeah. You have all these 7, 8-year-old, 5-year-old, you know, proteges on getting a million followers. But back then, right. 8 years old was pretty young.
Right. And also I kind of had to seek it out myself. I was around music, but I didn't have, my dad wasn't, you know, I don't think any parent is making their kids play drums. Trying to keep them away from the drums, I think. But I also didn't have any older brothers or older cousins that were hipping me to things. So anything that I learned, most of the stuff I learned kind of on my own and stuff I gravitated, the music, I was around the music, but like I said, a lot of big band, a lot of jazz through my dad. And the stuff they started gravitating towards, for instance, I was going to tell you a couple of my earliest favorite drummers, two of my biggest influences at a really young age, they're so different, but was Buddy Rich and Alex Van Halen. Okay. And, you know, and I still love them both. And I still listen to them both. And if a clip comes on one of their playing, I still watch. And, you know, watching Alex takes me back to being 8 years old and going, oh man, I love old Van Halen, you know? And
even with Buddy, no matter how many times you see a Buddy thing, you watch it. It's like, and people are still trying to figure out what he did.
I mean, what a badass. There's just, it's like to say he's a natural is such a cliche, silly undersell of how great Buddy Rich was. The command he had of the drum set, like just made it look effortless, you know?
Yeah.
Well, until he was in the middle of one of those like marathon, out of this world, single stroke roll where you're going, holy shit. And then you're going, okay, he's not making it look easy because that looks really hard. And he looks like he's about to have a freaking heart attack right now. Yeah. sweating and growling and going for it. And I mean, I saw Buddy play 3 or 4 times when I was a little kid. He'd play out at Disneyland. Mm-hmm. They'd always do these big band summers out there. And they'd have the Glenn Miller Orchestra and the Count Basie Orchestra. Louis Bellison would play out there. So Buddy would always kind of close the summer season out at Disneyland. He played like 4 or 5 nights in a row, a couple sets a night out at Carnation Plaza. And me being a drummer at age 8 or 9, my dad would take me out and I could kind of sit on the side of the stage, honestly, about 15 feet from him. And, you know, I'm up on the stage, like basically next to the monitor board, watching him play. And it just, it had such a profound effect on me. And I mean, it's just, it was cool. I would go there knowing, I'd go like before the show would start, after I'd seen him play a couple of times, even at age, like I said, 8 or 9, I'd go, okay, I'm about to watch this guy play drums. He's the greatest drummer in the world. And he's going to blow me away. And I know that there's no chance in hell that he's going to stumble or mess up. it's just that he doesn't do that. You know what I mean? And I was always so impressed with the fact that I go, this guy just, no matter what, I know that he's got this, no matter what, you know what I mean? And yeah, every time it was just astounding watching him play and watching the energy come off those drums from literally, I could spit on him, you know what I mean?
Right.
That close. And it was just like life-changing, man. And, you know, speaking, we talked about, not on the air, but you and I at the beginning of this conversation, we talked about Vinny for a minute. And I brought Vinny out. My dad and I brought Vinny out in like 84, maybe right around the time I met Vinny, to see Buddy play. And we introduced Vinny to Buddy. And it was really really cool moment. Yeah. I wonder if Vinny got a picture that night. Obviously no one had phones then. So like to have a camera, you really had to have this big, be carrying a camera, right?
Yeah. So,
I don't know if Vinny and Buddy got a picture, but I've got a great picture I should send you after this phone call I've got a great picture of Vinny and I out at Disneyland seeing Buddy play.
Wow.
You know, and let me hang up from my, let me decline my son who's trying to call me right now. Sorry about that. Anyways, yeah, I've got a great picture of Vinny and I out there. I'm 12 years old and I've got like a Zildjian sleeveless shirt on with like parachute pants, and Vinny's like skinny as a rail with like this mustache and a mullet, you know, and
right,
probably
right.
28 years old. It's awesome. Such a great picture, man.
So did I read somewhere, or did I dream it, that he was your godfather, Vinny Caliuta?
Yeah, no, not godfather, but I had an interesting relationship with him because I met Vinny, I think either 83 or 84 out at an AM show, and I was like 10 or 11. And it's funny, he was playing at the Simmons booth back when Simmons was like a cutting edge, brand new thing, right? And they'd have this booth that people would all get packed in there, you know. And he was playing at, you know, whatever, 11, 1, and 3. He'd do like three sets a day for, you know, play for 20, 30 minutes.
Was he spaghetti in between?
No, but he was smoking cigarette. We were in this tiny, tiny little sweat box with foam on the walls. Everyone's in there just smoking and playing. And, you know, no one thought anything of it. You know, I was like, yeah. I mean, the tiniest little confined space where you couldn't breathe anyways. He's just smoking and playing drums, you know. And I recognized him because I read Modern Drummer magazine. And they had these great Yamaha ads that were like on the spines. They were on the edge. They were slender ads that were on the sides of the pages. And each issue in the early to mid 80s, they would always, you know, Yamaha would run like at least four or six ads where you'd open up one, you know, one side is Vinny and the other side it's Rick Murata. And then you turn the page and one side it's Omar Hakim and the other side is Peter Erskine. I'd never heard him play, but I'm like, I know that name. I see him in those Modern Drummer ads for Yamaha drums. He must be famous, you know? And I went and saw him play and it completely just jarred me. It just like, it spun me around and I was like, holy shit. So I'm like a fourth grader, right? So after the show, I introduced myself to him and I get him sign my autograph album that I had him sign that weekend. Jeff Porcaro, I got a good picture somewhere of me. I found recently of me and Jeff Porcaro when I met him for the first time when I was 10 or 11, because I later became friends with Jeff and knew Jeff fairly well before he passed away in 92. But anyways, you know, I got pictures of me getting Dave Garibaldi's autograph and Vinny's autograph and Jeff's autograph. But anyways, I saw him play and I started kind of following him around the NAMM show, kind of like a lost puppy dog. And he was totally cool to me. He's like, hey, follow me over to the Zildjian booth. I'm going to get a dry t-shirt and I'll get you a shirt. I'm like, well, I'm going to get a free Zildjian t-shirt. Wow. You know? And we'd walk from Simmons over to the Zildjian booth and he would get stopped about, I don't know, every 6 feet. Even back then, he was just, he was such a star on the rise at the time. You know what I mean? There was such a buzz about him around that time. He was just out of Frank's band a couple of years. He'd been playing with Joni Mitchell, starting to dominate the studio scene in LA, you know, and just on fire, you know? And so, you know, he would play a lot of Sunday nights up at the cool night of the Baked Potato, right? The jazz club in LA was Sunday nights, kind of. That was like Sunday, Monday nights, oddly enough, instead of Friday or Saturday. Sunday, Monday nights were like, I don't know, just that they had the extra special gigs. And there was a band that Vinny had around that time that was comprised of Joni Mitchell's backup band, touring band at the time, which included, it was Larry Klein on bass, Michael Landau on guitar, and Steve Tavoloni, who played this like, you know, like a MIDI saxophone or something awful. But they called themselves Dog Cheese, and Dog Cheese would play the Big Potato. And it was them basically, they'd go out with Joni and kind of have to like keep it on about five or six, you know? Mm-hmm. And then they'd be home and they'd want to go out just like blow, and they'd go to the Baked Potato and they fucking just shred and just tear the roof off the place. And ask anybody, there's a handful of people that got to see those shows in the mid 80s, Dog Cheese shows. They were just phenomenal. But Vinny would always keep like a couple seats What's that?
You can't pay for those. That's a lesson. You can't pay for that kind of stuff.
Well, and not just that. The thing is, because there is a misconception that I took lessons from Vinny, and I never sat down and took lessons from Vinny. But what it was at that age, he would put me on the guest list. I had his phone number. I'd call him. He'd answer the phone, probably answer really dumbass questions that I was asking at age 10 or 11. But he took the time, and he would talk to me, and then he threw me on the guest list. And I grew up in Orange County, and it would be a school night, right? Sunday night. So my parents would maybe take a nap on Sunday afternoon, and my dad would drive me up from Orange County. We'd go up to North Hollywood, Studio City or whatever. He'd have a couple seats, like right behind the drums. And we'd get in, and I get to sit right, like, you know, 2 feet from him and watch him play. So like you said, like, these were like invaluable lessons, but it was never the two of us sitting down with a metronome and a practice pad and opening up stick control. But I mean, yeah, anyone can do that. Right. But it was like to be able to have a direct line to him for any silly ass questions that I had, and him putting me on the list for gigs and setting me up with a chair next to the drums. I mean, that was unbelievably generous and valuable. Me, you know, so I owe Vinny a lot in that respect. That's the best,
you know, sitting next to somebody, even Buddy, and just watching people play. And even sometimes just hearing stories, because then as you get older and you're hearing certain stories that maybe you're not so aware of, or you're thinking about, well, is this a good thing? But then just listening to their advice and what they have to say, that's priceless lessons as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, a couple of the guys like that, they were good to me at a young age. And that I still know, or like Jim Keltner, you know, all these guys were guys that I kind of met from following him around in the NAMM show, you know, and tugging on their shirts. And they're like, this kid seems nice and cute kid and, you know, ambitious. You know,
that's what keeps every generation, you know, they always say, don't meet your idols. I mean, all my idols that I've met growing up, you know, they helped me, and that put me in the position that I'm in now. If they didn't help me, or, you know, give me some of their time, and like same thing with Vinny, with you, and teach you, you know, advice, or just, you know, not officially, but watching them. That's how you learn. You know, that's how you learn. Schooling. You know, if you're going to be a jazz musician, you're going to read charts, you're going to play in a Broadway show, that's all well and good. But if you want to be in, you know, a pop star or a rock drummer, or you want to be in a band or whatever, it's a totally different way to teach somebody how to be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I, you know, around that same time I met John Robinson, and he, there was two times that my parents drove me up to LA, and he let me sit in on a couple sessions when I was like 11, 12 years old. There's a studio no longer in LA that any seasoned old studio LA vet would tell you about, called Lion Share Studios.
Oh yeah.
I never worked there, because by the time I was working, it was gone.
It was gone, yeah.
But when I was 11 or 12, I remember my mom dropping me off, and I got to sit in a room with John, and George Duke was producing, and it was a Barry Manilow session. And so I got to hang out at a Barry Manilow session, and then John let me come up to Ocean Way a couple months later, and I watched him record with John Anderson from Yes. Wow. I could just hang out and be a fly on the wall as a kid, just watching him roll tape and do takes. And it was like, and it was great, because I still know John, and whenever I run into him.
They're all proud of you. And there was something, obviously, that they saw in you, you know, because those guys meet a lot of people, let's face it. There was something that they obviously saw in you, that they knew you had the talent and something good could happen. So that's right. Great time to mention.
Yeah, man. And you know what? And my parent, and just to tame, I won't go into stories, but just a couple other honorable mentions of Greg Bissonette. I've been buddies with since I was like 12. Yep. Terry Bozio. Keltner and Jeff Beccaro, rest in peace. It's like, you know, they were all really good and really supportive and helpful to me at a young age. And more than once, even in recent years, even maybe a year or two ago, more than once, I've been reminded, my mom will remind me when I'll be somewhere and I'll say, yeah, this or that, or yeah, this kid, you know, I'll tell you a funny one. My kids were asking me about it the other day. I was like, yeah, this seems kind of weird. You know that I think if you really want to, you can kind of just go online. And even if it's not up right away, if you spend 5 or 10 minutes, you can basically find anyone's address. It's really easy to like do your homework.
There's good and bad about social media.
It doesn't happen often, but it happens. And I was trying to explain to my kids the other day, but then I kind of put myself right about it, which is I get fairly often, I'll get just an envelope sent to me from a name I don't recognize, and I'll open it and it'll have a self-addressed envelope and like 2 or 3 paper part of a CD that you take out, you know, with a little letter. Hey, Josh, you know, if you wouldn't mind, we, you know, just sign these and send them back to me, you know? And first, my knee-jerk reaction is kind of like feeling sort of intruded upon and being like, oh, really? You just send me shit at my house? And yeah, just right. Sign all the shit and send it back to me, man. Thanks.
Right.
Kind of like, well, hey, wait a second. You know, but like, maybe I don't feel like it. Or, you know, who gave you my address? Or, you know?
Right. Right.
And the other day, I was sitting there with one of my kids, and my kid's like, just look at that. It's like, sign up. It's going to take you 30 seconds. Sign up for this guy. He says he's a big fan of yours. He lives in the middle of nowhere in a town I'd never heard of before in Texas. I'm like, okay, screw it. And I signed the stuff, and I'm like, you know, it's like.
You made a dream come true for somebody.
It took a minute and a half. But, you know, the grumpy kind of cynical part of me is like, you know, off, man. I don't want to send me shit and tell me what to do.
Going up at your house, ringing your doorbell. It's like,
yeah, you know. Yeah. Yeah. Luckily, wow. It's funny, man. The kind of fans that I have, I've had people say, do you have any weird fans that show up places or weird fans that this or that? I think the thing is, I think the people that have weird fans are singers that are singing stuff and people out there that are either misinterpreting what they're saying or thinking that they're singing specifically to them. So right. They've got to go knock right. on the door. They have to be friends with them. They're going to jump the fence. They're going to meet you no matter what. My fans are all just cool drummers or cool musicians that read liner notes. Right. You know, that's what I would say. They're just right. people that are like, yeah, how cool, man. Freezes with Weezer and Michael Bublé and Devo. And they just go, that to them is cool. And it's kind of starts and stops there.
Right.
There's no psycho at home cutting themselves up and reading the lyrics and being like, I've got, you know, I'm going to kill them.
And that's how we grew up. You know, mm-hmm. that's how we grew up. We read liner notes. And then, you know, I would do that. I met Steve Ferroni when I was 14 years old. I watch Average Nice. Five Band record. You know, so, I play hooky from school, and I befriended the studio owner because we played one time, and he came to see us, and he told me, you know, he ran Atlantic Studios, and long story short, he invited me up. He said, sit in the corner. Don't say a word. If somebody asks you to leave, just get up and go out. And I met Steve Ferroni, who I was idolized. And that was it. I know him since I'm 14 years old. And I got to watch Average White Band. And then, you know, that led to meeting other people. And that's how you
get it. Great.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, God, people have to look up, you know, the list of who you play with, because that'll take up enough time. But Devo, you've been with Devo now since what, 96, 97?
Yeah, since about 96. And, you know, it's funny. I posted something on my Instagram about a month ago, which my brother found an old videotape of us on Christmas morning in like 1982. So I was about 10. And I open up an LP and it's a Devo record, right? And, you know, and I'm in like Winnie the Pooh pajamas. I'm in pajamas with freaking feeties on them. I'm still a little kid. I'm like in third grade or something, right? Second grade. And I'm dancing around with this Devo album. Yeah. And, you know, here I am, like, you know, that same week I'm driving up to SIR to go rehearse with them for these gigs that we just did. We just did a handful of shows. And it's like, to me, for me personally, there's a couple bands specifically that are probably, you know, some of the smaller bands as far as record sales that I've been in or worked with over the years, but mean the most to me because I'm such fans of theirs since I was a kid. And one is Devo, being a huge Devo fan since I was 8. And another one is The Replacements and Paul Westerberg. you know, I'm just such a fan of Paul's and have been since I was 15, 16. I used to dream of just meeting him one day, let alone, hey man, I've been making records with this guy for 20 years now. You know,
yeah.
It's to me that for me, that's a personal success that it just means a lot, you know,
yeah.
And I feel good about him. So
like, as far as like a warm-up routine, before you go out to play, because you are such a high energy drummer. I mean, the Vandals, I mean, that stuff, you know, I like a lot of that stuff, you know, and I was never into the punk scene, but your singer had such a melodic kind of voice, so it made it a little bit more poppy, you know, so it was that punk pop kind
of. Sure, yeah.
You know, but your drumming, were you a hyper kid? Like, how do you your drumming is just
It's funny you said that. It's funny you said that, man, because two nights ago I played up in Sacramento with the Offspring and we played this big festival out there. And I've been home from Greece for like 3-4 days and I did a session up in LA, but it was, you know, you're starting and stopping. You're not really playing you're not sweating and going for it. So, you know, I kind of had kind of a mellow week at home, right? The one session. And then I fly up on Saturday afternoon, the day of the gig, and you're sitting backstage and you're talking with friends and family that are there, whatever. And then, you know, and I'm also, you know, I'll be 49 in December. So I'm not a kid anymore.
That's Christmas, baby.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I'll be 49 at Christmas. So anyways, it's funny because that night I didn't hurt myself. Right. And I got through the show fine, but I told my wife, it's like, she came with me to the gig. I went, man, it's like tonight took me a minute at the beginning of the set, because it's like that particular night. And actually most nights, I actually don't warm up, and that's probably not a good thing, but I don't warm up a whole lot. And I mentioned to her after the show, I said, you know, I've seen Danny Carey do, and I know some other drummers that do it, even just, and not even the wrist, just getting your heart rate up. I've seen guys like for like 2 minutes before going on stage, on the side of the stage, like jumping rope.
Right. I was just going to say.
Actually, to wake yourself up and really start to like actually getting your heart beating. Because I go, man, we've been sitting home for the last couple of days with the dogs and the kids, and I all day today. Came up, we didn't sound check, so we didn't play at all because it's the festival and we're hanging out. We go to catering and we're talking and having a laugh. And then you go on stage, it's like, okay, go. And the light, and you're like, holy shit. You know, and you throw yourself into this thing with zero warm-up. It's like, I pulled it off fine, but I felt it. You know, and I went, what am I doing? Like never warming up or jumping rope or anything, just like waltzing on stage.
Stretching. Arrogant,
like I'm 23, you know. But I'm still, knock on wood, pulling
Thank
it off.
Thank God.
But,
yeah, no, you're in great shape.
I've gone through phases where I've warmed up a bit, but it's not a regular thing for me. You know, it's funny. I'll just tell you now. I have almost like a superstitious thing that I do. The only person I warm up with, and I don't know how I started doing it, but I can't not do it, or we can't like go on stage, is with Sting. Every gig I play with Sting, and the only reason I say this is because some people, if they follow me on Instagram, they could go, I've seen him warm up. What does he mean he doesn't warm up? Well, the other night with the Offspring, I didn't warm up. And my Devo shows I just did, those gigs, I didn't warm up. Sting, even though it's physically less demanding of a job than like going on the Offspring, warmed up. It's more physical. But I started doing a thing. It's a It's a thing I saw Peter Erskine do. And then when I posted it, I've heard a million guys go, oh, I used to do that drum line all the time. That's a famous warm up, which is, I don't know how I stumbled on it because I'm a big Peter Erskine fan, but the last thing I do is like sit around a YouTube people's warm up routines, you know? So I'm clicking around and it says Peter Erskine for some practice pad ad or something. And I clicked on it or something. And he did this thing where, this thing where I forget where he starts. Let's say he starts at 8, but he does at a consistent tempo, not too fast, but not slow, going 8 on each hand, 7 on each hand, 6, 6, 5, 5, 4, 4, 3, 3, 2, 2, 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, back up to 8, oscillating in between that, right? So I do that. And once you get down to 1 and 2, especially if it's kind of fast, it's kind of like almost not worth it. I go in between, I go from, what do I do? I go between 6, I go 6, 5, 4, 3, 4, 5, 6, 5, 4, 3, 4, 5, 6 on each hand for 5 minutes straight to the first track on a Frank Zappa record called Jazz from Hell, which is all like synclavier computer music. Mm-hmm. And there's a song called Night School. And it's the perfect tempo, and it's in 4-4, but with a bunch of weird, like kind of like polyrhythmic, jagged elbows being thrown into it constantly, even though it's basically in 4-4. But yeah, I play it down. I do that warm up, and I start, and I can't miss a beat. If I miss a beat, I have to start over from the top, and it's a 5 minute thing. So I'm totally concentrated, and I just go, yeah, 6, 6, 5, 5, 4, 4, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, 6, 5, 5, 4, 4, and it's almost just like a meditative thing too, you know. But the joke is, like, you know, people will come in the room and they'll go, "Have you done Frank yet?" Literally, when are you gonna do Frank? Dominic Miller sings guitars the other night in Greece. He goes, "I haven't heard any Frank yet. We're playing in 10 minutes. I go, "Oh shit, right." You know, and I'm half asleep. Oh, I better, you know, I get my phone. I put my phone in my pocket right here so I can hear it, you know, not too loud, but not too far away. And to be honest, on gigs like one-offs, when I don't have a practice pad backstage, I just look for the nearest couch or what's a surface I can play where it's not too soft, but I'm not hitting a table where it's going to drive everyone crazy, sticks on a piece of metal, you know. So I find something that's kind of like forgiving, but you know, and you know, spend 5 minutes and I do my little Frank Zappa Night School Peter Erskine warm-up routine.
Hey, listen, it works, right? And like you said too, you even mentioned it also helps your mind.
Yeah,
it all, you know, because you know you gotta put you know what it's like, you know. But people out there, you gotta be in a certain mindset. You gotta forget everything that's happening and step in, like, you know, you're Josh Freese. I tease Jim Kelton about that. He'll say something to me and he'll go, "That person just wanted to talk to me." And I go, "Yeah, because you're Jim Kelton."
Well, I wanna say Sting was saying one day, it's like, yeah, you know, it's funny. Everyone's got these cameras. They like wanna take a pic, you know, they wanna take a picture with you. You know, it's everyone, like, these guys want to take a picture with you. And it's like, He's kind of almost saying, like, for what? I'm like, well, because you're world famous and respected and bitter. Like, of course they want to show their friend at work that they met you at the freaking truck stop,
and,
man.
And in their
no
mind,
one's going to believe them, you know?
Yeah, in their mind, while they're looking, talking to him, every police song is going through their head that they grew up with.
Yeah, yeah. So him, it's just him. He's bored of himself. He's like, it's just me. I'm like, yeah, well, dude, let me remind you who you are.
Yeah, exactly. But that's, you know, the way, but that's what makes people real and genuine. And that's,
you know, he's great, man. I mean, I will tell you, it's like,
does he make you exercise? Because he's into, I know, you know,
man.
Yoga. And has he tried to teach you yoga?
No, he kind of enables me by handing me Twix bars and Reese's peanut butter cups backstage, to be honest. Sting is surprisingly cool. Not that you'd think he wouldn't be cool, but I mean, I don't know. He just, like, when I met him in 2004, I really thought that he was going to be too busy being rich and famous, basically, to care about the gig. I don't know why I thought that. Sometimes guys that have been around for that long and have made that much money and have sold that many records and are older than I am, I'm like, how could they care anymore? Do they still care, you know? And I was blown away at how much he cares. and how into the gig he is. And
musicians.
He's a musician, man. He's a bass player. Just when you go, it's Sting and he's a celebrity and he's saving the rainforest. No. He's got all these fabulous, rich and famous friends.
He's a musician.
He's a fucking bass player, man. A singer and a songwriter. And that's what he does.
Yep.
He's not just a tabloid celebrity, but you forget that sometimes. And not until I started working with him, I'd have to remind myself, Josh, what were you thinking? Of course he eats, sleeps, and breathes music. He's Sting, and he's written more hit songs than I've written postcards in my life. You know what I mean? It's it's unbelievable the amount of work and the incredible things he's done. But what else is cool about Sting is that, aside from being really knowledgeable about classical music and heavy into jazz and stuff, because of where the Police came from and the era that they came up in London, meaning the mid to late 70s, mm-hmm. he's actually really well versed in a lot of punk rock stuff. So yeah, he can sit around and talk to you about Weather Report all day, but he'll also sit there and talk to you about the Damned or the Buzzcocks or the Sex Pistols or, he did gigs with all those bands. So I'll go, oh, I forget that he knows who Captain Sensible from the Damned is. Wow. Most guys that were just talking about classical music or talking about Miles Davis wouldn't be talking about so-and-so from the Buzzcocks. How those worlds don't usually meet, So that's really cool. Just the both sides of the fence that he can play. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, he's a great, that's the thing. And obviously he picks you and Vinny because he's going to play with, and Omar back in the day. I mean, he's always played. And of course, I mean, Stuart Copeland, let's face it. Stuart's one of those guys that, I always say this, there's drummers that play, they do their gig and they're great. But there's drummers that change the world by influencing thousands of other drums.
I forget who said it, but I really love, and it wasn't a famous guy. I think it was a friend of mine or somebody that mentioned this casually a year ago. And I've used it a million times since, because it made so much sense. It said what John Bonham was to drums in the 70s and popular music and having a style and a voice that launched a million drummers and still influences them today, that was Stewart in the 80s. Stewart was the John Bonham of the 80s. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Every decade, somebody comes along and...
I mean, you know what I mean? Because, yeah, sure, there's a million other great drummers that came up in the 80s, but we're talking what great, unique drummers were also selling tens of millions of records that everyone... girls have their posters in their room. You know what I mean? They might not have a... might not have a Jack DeJohnette poster in the room, teenagers, or Steve Gadd poster, who hears these phenomenal drummers, but just meaning in the mainstream pop culture, mm-hmm. kids, they're not all over MTV all day long. So for someone like Stuart Copeland to be in a band that's all over MTV, but be that unique and
a new style.
Oh man, just so interesting and a breath of fresh air and just no one else like him, drummers know what this means when you say it, or other musicians, but I've tried to explain it to friends that don't play or to my wife, and I'll say, Stuart Copeland, he can play 2/4 and you can go try and play the same thing. But it's, and that goes to be said for lots of different drummers, musicians, obviously everyone's unique, but I go, I've watched everybody try and play like Stuart and no one can, and you can almost do it, or you can play a Bonham groove, but it's not John Bonham, it's just that thing, man. It's that little thing that,
Yeah, and that's like Bernard Purdy. I've sat next to Bernard Purdy when he plays the Purdy Shuffle. Now,
so great.
I could be in another room, and if somebody's playing that, I know right away, Bernard's playing. Because, like you say, there's certain people that that's what they do, and that's their thing. They invented it, more or less. Almost.
I listened to Bernard Purdy this morning at 7:30 in the morning when I was driving my 14-year-old boy to school, the high school. Something came up, alphabetically, something was showing up on the screen on my car. It was connected to my phone, showing songs alphabetically, and it was started on A, and I was going through songs. I got to B, I got to Babylon Sisters, right? Wow, B-A. Yeah. And I go, we're going to listen to this. And he goes, what's this? I go, we're going to listen to Steely Dan because your mom's not in the car. My wife hates Steely Dan. My wife hates Steely Dan, and I love Steely Dan. I'm such a Steely Dan like freak, and she's just like, oh, I hate those guys. She hates it. It's comical. It's really funny hearing us go back and forth on it.
I could see why, you know.
But I mean, I get it. It's such a thing. You're either going to love it, or if you don't love it, you're really not going to like it at all, you know.
And we appreciate every, you know, Gad's on there. Jeff, man. Rick Marotta's on there.
I mean, I got into Steely Dan the same way I got into Zappa when I was 12, which was reading Modern Drummer magazine. It always goes back to reading Modern Drummer magazine when you're in fifth grade, right? Reading Modern Drummer and hearing these drummers talk about, you know, either that or seeing like the Asia record that was like being reviewed or something. And back then, when there's no internet, you get an issue of Modern Drummer magazine, you're going to read it from top to bottom because that's all the information you're going to get about drums that month. You're not going to get it anywhere else. And so I remember reading like, oh, there's a record and Steve Gadd plays on it. And Rick Marotta plays on it. Bernard Purdy plays on it. Jim Keltner plays on the Asia album, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the first record I bought. And still my favorite Steely Dan record. But that blew me away reading about, you know, I read about Steve Gadd's performance on the title track, Asia. And I was like, oh, I better check this out. So I rode my bike to Music Plus or Tower Records or whatever and spent my $14 and bought the LP. And the same thing with Frank. I would read Modern Drummer. I'd read about these guys, Terry and Vinny and Chad Wackerman, everyone talking about, well, you know, the time I spent in Frank Zappa's band, you know, I mean, Frank, that was the most challenging stuff I've ever done. So I'm, you know, 11-year-old me's taking notes like, this guy Frank Zappa sounds like he's really giving all these drummers a run for their money. I better check him out, you know. And so that's how I got into Frank, is hearing all these guys talk about, well, you know, going, you know, being in his bands, like going to boot camp, and you know, you graduate from the Frank school, you can go anywhere you want, and you know, I was like, oh shit, okay. So yeah, just hearing guys talk about bands like that in Modern Drummer is what got me into Frank, is what got me into Steely Dan. Yeah.
I thank you for your support. You know,
Man.
And you've been on the cover, you know, how did
many
that
times
feel? Growing up reading it, and then now you know, you've been on the cover a couple of times.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I've been on the cover 4 or 5 times. And I remember the first time, especially, it's just like, well, I remember the first ad I was in. I was in a DW ad where DW would get one page and they would put like a bunch of different guys and almost like little bios underneath them and tell a little story about them, because they only had freaking, I've been with DW since 85, and they were a tiny company in 85, man. And I was 12 and I got a pedal endorsement with them. When I was 12, I was playing in a cover band out at Disneyland, and I got a pedal endorsement for the chain drive pedal, right? Anyways, my point is, I was in an ad. I remember Tommy Lee was in the ad, and maybe Johnny Hernandez from Oingo Boingo, maybe Chad. It was just a small handful of guys that played the drums and or the pedals. Anyways, I was in that ad. I just couldn't believe it. I think my dad bought 20 copies of the magazine because I was in this tiny, tiny little ad. But then, you know, you graduate to like, now I'm me and one other guy are in an ad. Now I've got my own ad. Oh, shit. Now I'm getting a story. I mean, it's not the cover, but it's the second one in line, you know, or an up and coming thing, or, you know, or in the Modern Drummer update, I've got a little mention from Robin Flans, or, you know. But the cover, that's just a whole nother thing. When you're on the cover of Modern Drummer magazine, it's just, it's mind blowing. And then, like I said, after working with your heroes for years, and you go from like you can't believe they're calling you to like, I'll call them back. You know, it was always funny to me when, like right now, when I said to you, I've been on the cover 4 or 5 times. I don't remember how many times. I could actually sit down and figure it out, but it's been at least 4 times.
Your career, you're one of the greatest drummers and one of the hottest drummers. And there was that period where, like I said earlier, Kenny was the only other one that wasn't like, if he wasn't on the record, you were on the record. I'm a pop head. So I really, you know, all the pop stuff that you did, I knew that you could do all that other stuff. And I like that more. I like the guys that, if they want to play with their chops and they want to do that fancy drum stuff, that's great. But playing with Michael Bublé, or playing on a machine and boxing and that kind of stuff. You know, that's the stuff you want because you want to be on the radio. You know?
Yeah, yeah, of course, of course. Yeah, I told my dad and his wife went to go see Michael Bublé about 2 weeks ago. And I said, hey, Dad, how was the concert? So he just left me a message saying we're going to go see Michael Bublé. And I was out of town. I went, okay, cool. I remember that he mentioned that. How was Michael Bublé? He goes, oh, it was great. It was way better than I thought it was going to be. I wasn't expecting much, but it was so good. I said, you know, I played on some of his records. He goes, you have? I go, yeah. I go, I've actually played on a couple of his biggest hits, like that song, Just Haven't Met You Yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny, man. I tell you, because out of the hundreds of records I've been on, the track Just Haven't Met You Yet is one of my favorite tracks that I've ever, like, is in the top 5 or 10 of when people go, what are your favorite songs you've played on? Or what, you know, that song to me, everything about the song, and trust me, there's plenty of songs that I play drums on that forget about the song, even just my drumming. I'm just not interested. It just doesn't do much for me. Or I go, I don't want to hear that because the song's not good. The drumming sounds boring. I never have to hear that band or that song ever again. Michael Bublé, that track to me, it's a great song. I'm proud. It's a shuffle. I'm proud of the groove. Everyone plays well on it. He sings great. It sounds great. The recording's great. Everything about it is like A class. And when it comes on the radio, I go, fuck, I love that I'm on this track. You know, I really do. It's really a great track, you know. And I feel good about being able to say that because there's lots of tracks I played on that are not good tracks. And that
and you were hired, Gunn. It's just a gig. It's just another
gig. Whatever.
You never know what's going to happen. You like you said before, you don't say no. When you're up and coming, you just take every gig. You don't say,
absolutely.
You know, Randy Cook, he was on a podcast a couple of weeks ago, and he said that's the worst thing to do is ask, well, how much am I getting paid? Don't worry about how much you get paid. You're going to get paid something, but just don't say no to the gig. You know, just do the gig because you don't know where it's going to lead.
Absolutely. And sometimes you go and you do the gig for free, you know, and you might meet a bass player on the gig that's going to land you an album next week that you're going to play on. Or you show up to the session. I always tell people it happened to me not too long ago. I was doing something kind of goofy, like, you know, what, not goofy, but just like not that interesting, like playing on a jingle for a, you know, Coke commercial or something. Right. And it was an in and out of the studio thing. But as I was leaving the studio, I ran into, this was a couple of years ago, I ran into the singer from Incubus and my friend Brendan O'Brien, who's produced a bunch of great records. I've worked with a lot of producer.
Great.
And they're like, Josh, what are you doing here? I'm like, oh man, I played on this, you know, whatever, a Fritos commercial or whatever it was. You know, they go, and they're like, oh, you're in town? I'm like, yeah. And they go, man, we're making Brandon a solo record, the Incubus guy. He's like, we've been like trying to play drums on it and chopping it up. But I mean, are you in town? Can you want to play on a track tomorrow? Sure. So I come the next day, I play on a track. They're like, well, shit, what are you doing tomorrow? Can you play on three more? Next thing I make this whole record with them just because I got out there and I went, drove that day to the studio to work on that session that wasn't very interesting. But I always tell people, go just get yourself out there and go play, whether it's for free or, you know, or whatever, just go, just mix with other people and
have
get
fun.
Out there and have fun and put yourself out there and show them that you're dependable and you're a good player and you're not a drag and everything, you know.
Yeah.
You do that enough, then stuff can start happening, you know?
Yeah. That's the best experience.
Yeah.
Because you don't, and that circumstance, you know, I always get into that. I love the whole circumstance thing. I always do, because one thing leads to another, and then you're going through some bad times, but, you know, you're only thinking about that time. You're not thinking about, well, this in the future, this is going to be better for me now or whatever.
You know, it's a great thing. It's sort of, I mean, he doesn't do music, but on the subject of this, there's an interview with Quentin Tarantino that was used as like bonus features or something, like on the Reservoir Dogs DVD. You can find it on YouTube. And if you do, if you're clicking around and trying to see it, it has something to do with him telling the story of how he got his first break and how he got Reservoir Dogs made. And if you're clicking around YouTube and you see like, he's sitting outside, it's during the day, it looks like he's in his backyard or something. He's outside, there's like some trees or flowers around him. And it's this 15-minute thing, maybe 10-minute thing, where he talks about how his writing partner took an acting class and the teacher from the acting class got the script and her boyfriend was teaching an acting class in New York with Ed that was in business with Harvey Keitel. And somehow he read it and he liked it. He gave it to Harvey by chance. And instead of it going into the trash, Harvey decides to read it. He liked it. He brought it to a movie company. Now there's some legit, it's so cool. Right. He went from being this kid that worked in a video store in Redondo Beach.
Yep.
All of a sudden he's making a movie with Steve Buscemi and Tim Roth and Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
And you know, a legend is born. And yep. And it's cool because while he's telling the story, he goes, I'm not saying that this works every time. He goes, I'm just going to tell you a story of how it can work. Here's how it can work, because this is what happened to me. And explains it, and you just go, oh man, it's so cool. It was just really, it's an inspiring, optimistic puzzle. Tale that he tells, you know?
Yeah, and it's a puzzle how everything falls. If you didn't meet this person, then you weren't with this person. Like you said, you didn't see Brendan that day, and...
You know what I mean? Yeah, yep. Yeah. And things like that have happened to me a lot, you know, in your situation. It was like, if I decided that I was too cool to show up and play on the jingle or whatever that was that day, I would have run into those guys. I would have made that record. So I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna leave the house. I'm gonna go up to the studio and say hi to whoever's in the hallway. you know
whatever. What? Some people would love to play on a Fritos commercial. You know, it's like
right. Yeah. Anyhow.
So before I let you go, and again, thank you so much, because I know, you know, you've been really busy and
yeah, man.
I appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Yeah. But let's talk a little bit about the gear that you use.
Yeah.
I know DW, you said DW, so you've been with them. What symbols? Paiste, right?
Yeah, I switched to Paiste. Next year, it'll be 20 years. I grew up a Zildjian guy. I was a kid playing Zildjian. I got a Zildjian endorsement when I was really, really young. And I played Zildjian from officially. I mean, I had a deal from 85 up until... when I switched in 2002. And I've always been, I don't know, I early on found gear that I liked and stuff that sounded good to me. And I've stuck with, like, I've been with DW Drums my entire life. I've never switched companies once. And I'm really proud of that. They make great drums. And I'm a loyal guy, and I've been with them for so long.
And you have to agree, right? John and Don, the people that, and Scott and Garrison and everybody, it's the people that you deal with.
Absolutely. And I've been dealing them with since they were in, you know, in a room the size of your bedroom, basically, starting off, and I was in sixth grade. And right. We both kind of, like, you know, sort of grown up together, sort of the company blossoming and my career doing well. And so it's been really, really nice being with them for the whole ride, you know?
And you stay loyal, you know, which is, you know, there's certain people we call drum hoods, you know, they just jump from company to company.
And that's why when I switched to Paiste almost 20 years ago, I thought about it long and hard. It wasn't a hasty overnight, these guys told me they'd give me more free stuff. Or these guys told me that, you know, when I was leaving Zildjian, I liked everyone at Zildjian a lot. And actually, I still like their cymbals. They make great cymbals. It's not like Zildjian make bad cymbals.
Right.
I was just gravitating towards something else. And I was starting to play some cymbals that Paiste was making that they weren't making 30 years ago. Caught my ear. The signature line, the traditional line, the 20 series. There was these things that weren't just the 2002s, which I've grown to really like too, but I remember as a kid, I still don't really like the Rude line, right? But as a kid, I remember hitting a Rude crash cymbal and just being like, oh man.
Garbage.
No, not into it. I hated it.
Yeah.
You know? But
for some people, it worked because the type of
music. Right. Yeah. I personally, when I played it when I was a kid, I hated it. And go, man, I'm never playing those cymbals. And at a session in probably, I don't know, 2000, there was some Paiste signatures cymbals up on the kit, and I played them and I went, wow, these sound great. Sounded so good. They recorded so well. They were just crystal clear and beautiful sounding, and the right amount of everything. I was like, God, I really like these cymbals. I started playing them more, but in the studio. Then I was like, I want my own set of cymbals, but I don't want to buy them from them because I don't want them saying to their friends, hey, guess what? Just bought cymbals from us. Yeah. I want to go to like a music store in Des Moines, Iowa, and just buy a set where I can do it and not have any drummers gossip about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
anyways, I forget how I did, but I ended up buying a set of cymbals.
And also, you have to like them.
Well, that's the thing. I went out and bought the cymbals. It was,
yeah, just because you're getting free stuff.
No, yeah. And when I finally decided, the thing was, so I was kind of like behind closed doors playing the Pisces stuff in studios. And I started kind of resenting my situation because I'd go out and play live. I'd be like, oh, okay, now I can't play the cymbals I want to play. I've got to play the cymbals I have to play. Right, and so right. Take these notions out that I'd at the time, at least, decided that I didn't like anymore at all. And when I finally said, you know what? And then I'd have to lie about stuff. Meaning I'd get asked, hey man, what cymbals did you use on that first Perfect Circle record? You know, what kind of, were they Ks? Were they A Customs? I'd be like, yeah, actually they were. And I describe what Zildjian stuff I was using. But meanwhile, this Pisces stuff, I'm like, why am I having to lie about this stuff? This is becoming silly. And when I left, you know, I was leaving a group of people that I really liked that make an amazing product. I was like, okay, there's no way that they're not going to take it personally, even though it's not personal. And, you know, them trying to kind of entice me to stay, like any company would, if someone's trying mm-hmm. to leave, they said, well, what if we do this? You know, like, give some more ads. Like, I don't need more ads. It's not about that.
Right.
Well, what about if we did more of this or more? I'm like, it's not that. This is what I'm wanting to hear. This is what I'm wanting to play. It has nothing to do with anything politically, personally, or amount of gear or ads you do. None of that stuff. It's strictly a sound thing that I want to do, you know? But like I said, it took me about a year and a half of playing this stuff secretly, the Pisces stuff, because I didn't want to just switch over to Pisces and then 6 months later go, I made a mistake.
Right, and then go
back to Zildjian, my tail between my legs, or then a month later I'm playing Sabian, and then 6 months later I'm playing this. It's like, I hate that when you see dudes jumping from company to company. It just looks lame, you know. It's always looked lame to me. So I'm proud. I've been the same stick. Well, you know.
Kelly, I mean, we all love Kelly and Eric and Tim Shady over there. I mean, you know, again, goes back to the people, you know, and Zildjian too. I mean, you know, I love all the people at Zildjian as well. I love all the people at Meinl. I love all the people at Sabian, you know, but you have to, and especially in the studio. In the studio, you know, we all know you use whatever's going to sound the best because you're making the record and you need the best sound. And, you know, whoever you endorse, if they're not giving you that sound, or you're in a studio that the engineer already has his Gretsch kit set up.
Oh, yeah, that happens all the time to me. All the time I'll show up and they go, hey, we're doing a record. We've got a kit that we love. It's this vintage Gretsch kit. We've got some old Ks. I mean, I want to say there was a time a couple years ago I came to a session. They were doing a record with a drummer already, and there was a couple tracks they kind of wanted to fix up. So, of course, I'm going to use the same stuff they were using. And I played the cymbals, and there were some Ks, and they sounded so great. And I think I remember emailing either Kirsten or someone over there going, man, I played some Zildjian stuff today, and I just want to say they sounded great. It's really good. You know what I mean? So anyways, there's no denying that they don't make an incredible, cymbal.
Everybody. I mean, the product is product, and it, you know, there's certain sounds, of course, that are going to be different, but it's really the people and the relationship you have that's really important.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and the younger generation has to believe, you know, now there's been so many cutbacks, of course, because of everything going on, budget cuts and everything. You know, the young kids that, you know, people used to email me, call me at the office and say, can you get me an endorsement? You know, can you get me free cymbals with so-and-so? You know, so-and-so. I saw you in a picture with so-and-so. Can you get me free cymbals? I'm like, absolutely not.
Yeah, because you start sniffing around doing that too much and they get wind of that. And then, you know.
Well, listen, I mentioned about your records. When are the new albums coming out?
Well, the first album comes out on October 29th. You can, stream or buy on iTunes. I think there's a limited edition of vinyl that's being done. I learned on the last record I made, don't make any CDs because no one wants CDs.
I know, you can't.
They either want it on their phone or they want the big piece of vinyl, you know, which is cool. It's like an art piece, you know?
Yeah, years ago, kids used to say, what's vinyl? Now they say, what's CD?
Oh, yeah, I have no idea. So anyways, their record's coming. So I've got these volume one and volume two. Volume one's coming out October 29th. And then the second one, we're trying to figure out a release date, but probably probably right after the first of the year. It's gonna, you know, it's probably come out 3 months later or something, but it's just a fun collection of wacky songs.
That's,
you know,
great. I love it. I love that they have a minute, you know, a minute. Yeah. Of song. That's great. I love it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Awesome, Billy.
Thank you, everyone. We'll see you next week on the Modern Drummer Podcast. One little shout out I'd like to give to this new company. Check this out. It's made out of broken cymbals.
Wow, nice. Oh, that's, yeah, cool.
This girl, Liz, she has a company, yeah, called Full Circle, and she makes all these bracelets and jewelry. And cool. I fell in love when I saw this, and it's cymbals. So it's like,
hey, man, you kind of just sold me. Now, tell me this real quick. Can you, because I like the idea of energy that's been put into something. Could I send her one of my like broken cymbals and have her make something out of it?
She would, I'm sure she would love that. Absolutely. You know what I mean?
Instead of like some cymbal, I don't know what company it was. I don't know who played on it, but a cymbal that I used on tour and sweat on and, you know, the whole thing.
That's her whole philosophy about not letting something that has memory go to waste. Well, listen, everyone out there in Modern Drummer Land, thank you for supporting us, and we'll see you next time on the Modern Drummer Podcast.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.